Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Hi, everybody.
Oh, it's too early in the morning for this shit. Even though you people are hearing it on a Saturday at 7 p.m., it's still too early in the morning.
It's almost 6 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, well, I just got up not too long ago. So shut the junk up, fucky.
Uh-huh.
You know what? You just do the Adam and Eve promo.
Okay. Go to Adam and Eve at the very end. Use the promo code. Well, no. Don't put on the... Go to adamandeve.gov. That'll work.
I'd actually be curious what that would go to.
Nothing, probably. Go to adamandeve.com at the very end when you're checking out. Use the promo code STATIC. You get 50% off of a given item. You get 3 free DVDs. Full-length movies, not like little scenes or anything like that. You get free shipping in the United States. And you get a free mystery gift.
Mysterious.
And actually, I know somebody that just ordered something, and when it came in the mail, she got stimulant gel.
Like clit stimulant?
Yeah.
Well, if it works, it's free, right?
I haven't gotten reports as to whether it works or not, but...
Hey, works, doesn't work. It's still free.
It's still free.
All right. So tonight, I'd like to talk about when artists lose their mind. And I don't just mean like a painter. By artist, I mean a writer, a director, a musical artist, an artist, whatever. You know, any kind of creative arts. You tend to see, if you go on long enough, they tend to kind of go insane after a while.
And
I do mean that in both the writing goes insane and the person goes insane after a while.
Well, Mel Gibson being a perfect example. Any of the Disney girls like Britney Spears, Lindsay Lohan, was Amanda Bynes Disney or was she Nickelodeon? I think she
was Nickelodeon, actually.
But anyway, yeah, you know.
I just remember her as The Rock's wife. No, that wasn't Amanda Bynes in Southland Tales, was it?
No.
I'm like, which one am I thinking of that was The Rock's wife in Southland Tales? She was one of those teen...
Amanda Bynes was actually younger than us.
Oh, okay.
About a generation behind us, so... But yeah, it's a lot of child stars, really, because you had...
But this is not just isolated to the child stars that go on.
Right, right. No, but, well, you know, like I said, Mel Gibson kind of lost his brain there after a while.
Well, what do you think causes it? Do you think if somebody is... Now, let's just say not a struggling artist. Let's, for right now, just go a famous one. Somebody that's world famous, lots of money, lots of attention... Do you think that is what drives them insane? That the ego starts to grow. That they're too much money. They get too much power, and they kind of lose touch with who they used to be
or who they really are. Period. I think anytime you'll see this in CEOs sometimes too. If you surround yourself with yes men, you're wildly successful, so you can afford to surround yourself with people that pretty much constantly agree with you.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's a brilliant idea, sir.
Brilliant.
Yes, sir.
Yes, you know. But I think
made
that
all
after
the
a
right
while.
Moves. Yes, of course you did, sir.
Yes. You know, I think after a while, yeah, you're going to go insane because there's no reality check.
Do you really think that's what happened with Mel Gibson with the I hope you get raped by a pack of niggers and where's my script for the Maccabees kind of stuff? And the Jew rant. Don't forget the Jew rant, too.
I think that was a little bit of insanity that was maybe seeded in Mel Gibson long ago, and maybe he just kind of
exploded out.
Yeah, exploded out, kind of turned into a racist fuckbag out of nowhere. You know, maybe he always had been, and it was a side that was well hidden by his his propaganda machine. You know, another one, Tom Cruise, nicest guy in the world. Every person I've known that's interviewed him, that either I've talked to them ancillary or anything like that, or they've talked about the interview, Tom Cruise, nicest guy in the world. You ever see that video of him put out by the Scientologists that wasn't really supposed to be out there?
Maybe. You'd have to be more specific on the video.
You really should. He's, he seems to have gone insane with Happy. And then you see little bits of insanity with him and, I forget who his wife was, but they had the baby and she had to remain completely silent during
the
birth.
Katie Holmes?
Katie Holmes, yeah. Maybe that was it.
Are you talking about like the jumping up and down on Oprah's couch shit?
Yeah, that was a good example too. You know, every time that you see him, he seems to have gone insane with Happy. Now, again, everyone I know that's interviewed him, nicest guy in the world, really cool. And I don't know him, so I can't speak ill of him personally. But there just seems to be something wired wrong.
Well, do you see something that happens where maybe somebody abruptly shifts? And I don't just mean like going from Democrat to Republican, but like a political view or something to the point where they contradict everything that they did that got them famous once they become famous.
I think to tell you the truth, there are a lot of them there that I see that are just signs of mental illness.
Because like I'm thinking of Dennis Miller. You listen to all his pre-9/11 stuff. He is hardcore liberal, hardcore libertarian. 9/11 happens. He's living in New York at the time. Now he's a hardcore conservative. We need to kill these goddamn Muslims. We need to suspend civil. And it was just like something in him.
Yeah.
You know, like 9/11 cracked him. Well, and he became a totally different person.
I think 9/11 did crack him. I think 9/11 cracked a lot of people. I really do. I think that was a big enough event that was a trigger for a lot of people. So, you know, I can't really blame Dennis Miller, because I didn't find him that funny to begin with, and now I find him not that funny and pretty disagreeable. So,
but you see what I'm saying? How how like his '90s stuff and his 2000s stuff. If it
night
wasn't for
day.
The voice, you would never know it was the same person.
Yeah, it was really night and day, and like I said, 9/11 was a big enough event. I think it cracked a lot of people and a lot of people that we don't hear of. My father-in-law, kind of after 9/11, out of nowhere, switched gears. He used to be an extremely liberal. He was never really a hippie or a beatnik, but he was more of a, oh, the leather jacket, motorcycle riding, leather jacket wearing, the greaser. But he was a very liberal greaser. And he was always kind of fighting the man, and 9/11 happened, and now he is a staunch Republican, to the point that he has lost a lot of his friends, and he has lost a lot of interaction with his family, and he's really kind of a dick now.
Well,
But you know, that's also a sign of mental illness. There are signs of, in a lot of stars, you see a lot of signs of mania. You see a lot of signs of manic depressive behavior. You see a lot of signs of schizophrenia, and a lot of stuff. You see a lot of signs of mental illness that falls on the autism spectrum. But that's because everything and its brother falls on the autism spectrum these days.
Now, yes.
But
well, like one I'm thinking of, and I'll be bringing him up a lot in tonight's show because he's exemplifies numerous elements. But Frank Miller, the artist writer that, you know, most people know from the Spirit movies, Sin City,
sure,
Daredevil comics, Elektra, stuff like that,
sure,
Batman: The Dark Knight Returns. He seemed to make a strange shift in both his writing and his personal life, and his writing in a couple of different ways too, like. He was, you go and look at 80s interviews from him, even early 90s interviews with him, hardcore liberal. He's always talking about how the people are what matter, and, you know, you got to fight the corporations and all that. Then Occupy Wall Street happened, and he had lost his mind. These people are leeches on society. They need to be put down. They're enemies to the establishment. And you go, how are you the same Frank Miller that in 1988, what happened in your life that it's like a hippie becoming a CEO. You know, it's like, what happened?
I've seen this before, and one thing that I've heard is that, people are liberal until they come upon some wealth, and then they have something to conserve, so they become conservative.
So you think the money corrupts?
I think that money plays a big part of it. You don't see a whole lot of poor, at least when it comes to fiscal policy, you don't see a whole lot of poor conservatives. You know, it's on the social side of things, you do see a whole lot of poor conservatives that...
Most of the conservatives in middle America vote against their own best interests, though.
Yeah, it's
weird. They vote against what would make them rich, so...
But let's not go down that road for this one.
But going back to Frank Miller... You look at the comics work he did in the late 70s and the early 80s. Very strong, not making a joke, female empowerment. He had incredibly strong, defined female characters. He knew how to write women in a way that was completely new to comic books outside of comics written by women.
Oh, yeah.
You look at the stuff he did post-2000. Women, I mean, in some of them, they print the script at the back of the trade. He's like, let's see a nice glistening shot of her ass and all this. And he's all about objectifying women. And every woman in All-Star Batman and Robin is a man-hating, ball-crushing dyke that's there to either be ogled at or to hate men.
Did he?
And you just kind of go, what? You used to write women, so now it's like he hates women, that's what he writes, is I hate women.
Which makes me wonder, did he go through a divorce?
I don't know.
Did he go through something personal in life?
He was a big druggie in the 90s, so maybe he wrecked his mind with heroin and coke, I don't know.
That could be it. But I mean, even look at Sin City.
Sin City's pretty anti-woman. I mean, every woman in that is either a whore or gets beat up.
Right.
That says something about your view of women there, doesn't it?
Yeah. And that may be something. And I look at that and I'm like, okay, who hurt you?
Yeah, you're clearly working through something, man.
Exactly. What happened to you in your life to go from Wonder Woman, which you talk about female empowerment comics, she has always been held up as a big female, which she comes from. A gentleman wanting to be in the S&M community, but
you look at the early Wonder Woman shit from the 30s or from the 40s.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Let's just say she got tied up a lot, and it wasn't always by the villain. Yeah.
And she did her fair share of. I mean, the Lasso of Truth, tie up the bad guy and make them confess. You know, and stuff like that.
But
so,
I mean, like you brought up Sin City.
Mm-hmm.
How can you look at that and see the same guy that would write Elektra, the same guy that would write Carrie Kelly? You just kind of, how is this the same writer? I mean, like I said, he clearly hates women now. And you can tell in his writing that, you can tell in his writing, not only has the quality dropped off precipitously, which, you know, is one of the things that he's clearly gone insane, but going with Frank Miller again, his writing style changed. And not for the better. He had a very unique storytelling perspective in the 80s. I mean, he brought a different style to mainstream comics that really shook things up.
Mm-hmm.
Then when he got to Sin City, and I get what he was attempting to do. He was trying to go for a more pulpy, style of writing, because that's what Sin City was kind of a love letter to.
Yes.
And he fell into this strange trap that he thinks repeating words is great prose. Like, it would have one panel that would say, and. The next panel would say, and she. The next panel would say, and she dove. And then the next panel would say, and she dove here. And it's like, that's the entire script, is just every single sentence, you just add one word to the previous sentence, and you go, that's not good writing, Frank. I've got one page that I need to stretch out to 20 pages of comic. That's just giving up, isn't it?
That has its place. Like
he does it in everything.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm just saying that has its place. That has its place in like the big dramatic moment of, and he fell off the building. So to you know, you can stretch that across a few panels on a page, but to do an entire comic that way, yeah, that's.
But and he's like, no, man, it's like lyrical poetry, man. And you're like, no, it's not. It's you've got, you know, it's like you've got 1 minute of material, but you have to be on for 20 minutes. So you stretch it out as long as possible. That's half-assing it. You know, that's not even half. That's quarter-assing it, man. You're not even trying. And that's everything he writes today. And then he's also got this weird thing that also goes to his insanity of how he sees the characters. Because if you've heard about the All-Star Batman and Robin bullshit, right?
No, I haven't.
You've heard of I'm the goddamn Batman.
Oh, yeah. I'm the goddamn Batman. Yeah, I've heard
that. Frank Miller's. Basically, what happened was DC gave him Batman and Robin. It's outside of regular continuity. He could do anything he wanted. And so he, in the press materials, this is the truest, most pure form of Batman ever. It goes back to Batman's roots. Batman is a sadist. He hurts people for the sake of hurting people. He kills. He kidnaps people. He berates people. He is a complete womanizer. And you're going, okay, that's everything Batman isn't. Yeah. How is this the most pure Batman ever?
And I realize that the... You know, the Kane stories and stuff like that during the origin... The Kane stories during the origin of Batman, I realized that those had to, because of the times, be calmed down a little bit. I know that the 1960s, the Adam West Batman and stuff, I know that that was campy for the sake of being campy and really geared towards kids in the 60s, so it had to be G-rated. But there has, yeah, that was one of the reasons why I never really cared for the Miller Batman comics. And this is.
But see, that's the thing. Go back and read Dark Knight Returns from 86. He got Batman dead on.
Yeah.
That was Batman. This, I'm the goddamn Batman. You kidnap a child right after his parents has been murdered and then chastise him. Don't be a pussy. Stop crying. Be a man. That's not Batman.
No, it really isn't.
You know, and that's what, and again, every female character in All-Star Batman and Robin, Black Canary, Wonder Woman, all of them, either whores or man-hating dykes. Again, he hates women, even though he seems to like these characters somehow.
Yeah, I don't know what the hell happened.
He went nuts. But then what happens on another level when you... And in the case I'm going to bring up, I'm not being snide. The guy admits that he lost his talent. Look at like Hunter S. Thompson in his last years. One of the reasons he claimed to have committed suicide is he knew he couldn't write like Hunter S. Thompson anymore. He didn't have it anymore. He lost it. He could not do what people expected out of Hunter S. Thompson when it came to writing. What do you think happens then? Shouldn't that be a wake-up call that maybe I should start trying to be like Hunter S. Thompson again, even though I am Hunter S. Thompson?
No, maybe instead of being a wake-up call, too, in the case of Hunter S. Thompson, it took a whole lot of drugs to be Hunter S. Thompson.
He was still doing the drugs.
I know.
You know, then.
I know. And maybe that is what got to him, was just the drugs became way too much. And the lifestyle that surrounded the ability to write like Hunter S. Thompson got to be too much, which it does. You know, I mean, living like that has to really wear thin on a guy.
But he made that choice to live like that.
I realize that. And he made the choice to not live like that, too.
And, you know, In all honesty, I think Hunter S. Thompson sullied his entire legacy. Not with those last couple of years of bad writing, with the suicide. That's a pussy way out. I think killing yourself, he completely sullied any kind of legacy Hunter S. Thompson ever would have had.
It's definitely going to be a horrible mark on it. That's for sure.
But I mean, like, in that case, he was still cogent enough to realize that he couldn't write like he did in the 60s and 70s.
Sure.
So, you know, even if the drugs were a necessary component, couldn't you at least try to emulate your style from back then to see, you know, instead of just kind of, I mean, by the 90s, he kind of changed to a 90s style of writing. And I would think that as a writer, I can say it's a you have to make a conscious effort. Like whenever I do a parody article or like a satire one, that's hard for me because I have to write against everything that I actually want to write for. So I have to keep pulling myself out of it and looking at it from above. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I understand where you're coming from. But again, why try and... It's...
But if you're not happy with where you are...
I know. Then if you try and emulate where you were and it just comes off as a piss-poor emulation...
Is it any worse than just piss-poor bad?
You know, well, yeah, maybe. To me, it is because... Well, we've seen this on friends that make internet videos when they try and make videos like another artist. And it comes, and I know they say that...
It comes across hollow.
Yeah, it comes across very hollow, and you go, oh, you're trying. And we can see that you're trying, you're failing, but you're trying. Aw. And it's... Yeah, it comes across as hollow instead of that imitation is the greatest form of flattery, blah, blah, blah. It just goes, you're just trying to ride on coattails. And I think that in the case of Hunter S. Thompson and a few other writers that I know, had they tried to emulate where they were, it would have come across as trying to ride their own coattails of former greatness. And it comes across as hollow, and it comes across, you know, you just read it and you go,
oh, isn't that cute?
You know, no, not all. Isn't that cute? It's oh, I feel so bad for him because he's trying, but
it's not working.
There's not enough cocaine in the world to make it work anymore. You know,
we can't stop here. It's bad country.
I know. You know, but that's it again. It comes across looking like you're trying to ride your own coattails, and it.
But then again, you've also got artists that won't give up like that, like Frank Frazetta, you know, the beautiful painter. When he had his stroke, he couldn't paint anymore, so he taught himself to paint with his left hand.
Right.
Sure, it wasn't as good as his old stuff, but he didn't fucking give up. And I mean, when he died, he was still, fuck you, I'm Frank fucking Frazetta.
Yeah.
You know?
And he was...
And he had a lot to overcome because, yes. I mean, to teach yourself how to paint like that with your non-dominant hand, that's an accomplishment, man. Yes. And yeah. It's still, the paintings looked like a Frazetta painting.
Sure. But I don't think, I think he was still, as an artist, trying to, he was, obviously because he had to, he was moving in a new direction. You know, yes, that old Frank Frazetta style comes out just like, if you look at a movie that Spielberg directs today and a movie that Spielberg directs in the past, you look and you go, oh, my God, that is such a feel-good, happy,
saccharine ending,
saccharine movie that AI. It got Spielberg all over the Kubrick, you know? And you could see the difference in styles.
Oh, yeah, you could see, to me, Act 2, The Flesh Fair, outside of the Chris Rock bot, really didn't feel Spielberg. That felt Kubrick.
That felt Kubrick.
And so did The City with the giant lips, yes, and all that. And but then the cartoon Robin Williams, you, yes, go, okay, that's Spielberg, through and through.
And even in Act 1, you could see that Spielberg was trying to shoot like Kubrick.
But it just came off like emulation, really.
It came off as Spielberg trying to shoot like Kubrick. And... I think in Frazetta's case, he had lost where he was
physically
lost where he was, but
he didn't give up though.
Yeah, there's still something in your brain going, no, fuck you, I am Frank Frazetta, I'm going to paint. Spielberg, unfortunately, was never going, fuck you, I am Stanley Kubrick, I'm going to do this for my friend. I mean, it's kind of came across that way, but it kind of came across a little hollow. And so you can do that in two directions, in that, in sometimes it works out, like in Frazetta's case, where his, you know, left-hand period. It's obviously a marked departure from his right-hand period, but there's still a little bit of Frazetta there. AI, obviously a marked departure from the Kubrick that we knew, but there was still a little bit of Kubrick there. And in the case of Frazetta, it worked. In the case of AI,
it did.
It didn't.
Well, then what about something with like, and I've never really liked this artist, but a lot of people do. I mean, clearly his movies still break box office, not records, but they make a shit ton of money. Adam Sandler. But you look at the early Adam Sandler movies, like Happy Gilmore or Billy Madison, and you could see he was at least trying to make a movie that had actual jokes in it.
There was a story. There was some
There was an arc to the characters, even.
The characters grew a little bit. And it was, especially in the case of like Happy Gilmore and Billy Madison, there was a bite to the humor. There was an edge.
It was a little bit of a juvenile edge.
It was a little bit of a juvenile edge, but there was a little bit of an edge there. And in recent Adam Sandler movies, you can see that, one, he's become a dad. I think you can clearly see his kids' influence on this.
But he also loads these newer movies up with every kind of gross-out joke, fart joke, poop. I mean, Christ, grown-ups had, what, 2 dozen different fart jokes in it? And you go... Really? Adam Sandler, you're a 40-something-year-old man, and you still think, is humor?
And that, I think that's a case of, both his audience growing up and going, really, dude? Come on. And the case of him, like I said, you can see his kids' influence. Kids think farts are funny no matter what. You can sit there with a young kid and go, and he's going to giggle every time. My nephew Tony is just like that, you know. He's 6. It's okay. You know, in the case of Adam Sandler, I think he outgrew his own humor. And he was, I think he's been trying to hold on to what worked for him in the 90s. And again, it kind of looks like a weird form of self-emulation. It comes across as hollow without any substance. And his characters and his writing, the arc is gone, but the fart is there. The growth is gone. The character development is gone, but all our gross out humor is there. And while gross out humor and hollow jokes and no character growth has its audience, hello, Project X, you know, I think the audience is there and it's certainly big enough with enough spending money that you're going to see characters in movies like that with no growth and no development and no consequence whatsoever.
What about then about everyone's favorite target, George Lucas? He clearly lost his mind by the 90s. He clearly fell in love with CG. And I mean, the fact that he would yell at his own fans for not liking the changes he made to their childhood favorite, and him going, look, it's my movie, I'll do whatever I want. Fair enough. But at the same time, why do you keep getting mad that they don't like it?
And I think that's another case of the yes man syndrome. I think Lucas...
Oh, God, just watch the extras on episode 1. You can see they're terrified to tell him his ideas are dumb. He'd be like, I want to do this, and they're kind of like, uh-huh. And you can see in their face they're going... Oh Christ.
You know, okay, I realize you're not a huge fan of them, but Apple as a company, the one thing that Steve Jobs did well, because he didn't really invent the stuff, he didn't really design the stuff, but he led his company and he retained the ability to tell his employees and his designers, even his wildly successful designers, no. And that ability to go, no. And that having somebody there that just goes, no, this is stupid, scrap it and bring me something else. that is a very, very powerful reality check. And I think people like Lucas lose that. They lose that one person there that can look at them and go, George, you're being stupid. You're making bad decisions. Trust me on this one. You know, you've got a seed of something good here. Let's make it grow in a different way.
Jar Jar Binks is not the right place to go.
Exactly. I mean, you know, and that clearly shows in Lucas's work. I mean, he had constraints on him for 77 Star Wars, for Empire and Jedi.
80 and 83.
Both constraints technologically on what he could do. So they came up with tracking and did it with models and such, and it came across brilliantly. And he had constraints of money, even, you know, a little bit less in 1980 and a little bit less in 1983. But then by the time Star Wars became a cultural icon and he goes, I want to make the prequels. You just had people driving up with dump trucks full of cash going, here, yes, we'll invest
do
in this one.
It.
And so he had no constraint anymore. And he just went, okay, I'm going to make the movie that was in my brain in 1977 that I couldn't make. And loosing those constraints changed the very fundamental feel of the Star Wars franchise. And a friend of mine that you know put the FCC constraints on him humor-wise, and he has to come up with new ways to get his gross-out humor and new ways to get his shock humor across in a way that's still FCC-friendly. And there's an inventiveness and a lot of fun there. Remove those FCC chains, and it just becomes
a lot of fuckity, fuckity, fuck, nigger,
funny, haha, laugh at me.
Well, and what about then music artists? That, well, okay, I won't specifically say music artists. Let's just say that, and the thing I'm going to bring up, the initial example I thought of was musical, but there are actors and that do this too. I know how this is going to come across, okay? I'm not attacking religion here, okay? But when somebody who is in an exploitation industry or something like that finds religion and gets born again, the way they make that abrupt, okay, I'm insane now shift and start bitching about all the movies they made in the 70s, or that they change like Cat Stevens, instead of I'm going classic rock, I'm going, you know, sitar music, and you just kind of go, what the fuck? How are you the same? The hell? You know, like Brad and I were talking on a Radiodrome, John Shepard, the guy that played Tommy Jarvis in Friday the 13th Part 5, the reason he didn't come back for Part 6, and before this he'd made other exploitation films and horror films, he found God. And now all he makes is Jesus films. And he spends all his time talking about how the horror films he made almost damned his soul to hell. And you just kind of like, okay, he went insane.
Well, Kirk Cameron, during Growing Pains.
Yeah, he went insane during Growing Pains.
During Growing Pains, he became the star. He found God, and all of a sudden things changed. There's a few examples of that happening where somebody, Prince, another perfect example, famous for Little Nicky and some of the dirtiest but most incredible songs ever created.
I disagree with that. I've never been a fan of his, but
I understand. But within his scene, you know, I mean, Purple Rain was one entire gigantic sexual innuendo, the entire fucking album. And sometimes it wasn't even innuendo. Little Nicky. Not Little Nicky, Darling Nicky. Anyway.
Yeah, Little Nicky's Adam Sandler. Yeah, Little Nicky's Adam Sandler. You're going back to 10 minutes ago.
Sandler in my brain. Ow. But, you know, Prince, when he became a Jehovah's Witness, he basically took his entire back catalog and goes, yeah, that whole deal of Seven and, I forget what the hell he did it with New Power Generation. It was one of his 90s hits, but there was no innuendo. It was just like, we're going to fucking 69 positions all night long, blah, 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 blah. He's like, all of that doesn't exist. I'm going to take all of my hits that you guys expect and that you guys like from the 80s and 90s, and they don't exist. And I'm going to do this new family-friendly, white, fully covered Prince stuff. And it didn't go across well.
Well, what about something like Glenn Danzig with the Misfits? How, you know, he was in the Misfits from 77 to 83. And, you know, he co-wrote almost all their stuff. And, you know, he was a big part of it and totally into the band. And then he quit. And then when Samhain came around, it was the Misfits don't exist. If you even bring them up in an interview, interview's over. I will not sign any Misfits merchandise. Those that Misfits stuff, I never did that as far as I'm concerned. You just go, what? I mean, I realize it was a bad breakup. But just to go, you know, all that stuff that I did that made me famous, gone.
But that, I mean, in the case of, I mean, Danzig didn't fundamentally change who he was. Yeah, he continued in the same genre. You can listen to Misfits music and you hear that Danzig style. And then you listen to his modern stuff and you go, oh, yes, that is most certainly the same style. You know, there's a heart of Danzig there, so I can't really fault him for that one. It would be kind of like me, we'll pick an ex-girlfriend out of the hat of many names, Melanie. Dated her in high school, she was a good kid, we had a rather bad breakup. Maybe later on in my life, if somebody asked me about Melanie, I'd be like, hey, I prefer not to talk about that. And it's not that I'm going, it didn't exist, it didn't happen, because it did, and it was a decent relationship. It's just something that I don't want to talk about because of the pain associated with it.
Okay, that's fine. But then what happens when something, and I'm not saying this changed the person at all because I've never met her, but when you just kind of say your early stuff literally did not exist, like Scream Queen Michelle Bauer, she was in a couple of hardcores. And she says her first movie was 1983's The Tomb.
Right.
And it's just kind of, yeah, those hardcores that are clearly me and that I took credit for and I definitely cashed the paycheck for those. No, my first movie's The Tomb, not those other four movies I made before The Tomb.
And, you know, again, I can respect an artist, especially when it comes to hardcore films, because there is still that stigma. Not everybody is as sexually related, you know, liberated as I am. If somebody found one of the tapes that I made, you know, way back when, and brought it up,
but I'm just saying, like, with the Michelle Bauer thing, is that fair to just kind of no? First movie is The Tomb,
even though
it's not the first movie she did.
I think as an artist, I think the right thing to do would be to yes, I acknowledge that I did that. It happened. I'm not proud. I don't want to talk about it. That's the right thing to do. However, again, you get enough of a propaganda machine around you, even if it's just an agent going, you're incredible, you're beautiful, you're a good scream queen, we've got a future here, and I can mold you. A lot of times, that's that propaganda machine at work, and that's how the artist interprets it.
So you know, is it like that thing, if you tell a lie enough times it becomes the truth, that if she keeps saying my first movie was The Tomb, eventually people are going to forget about Night Dreams and Cafe Flesh and Bad Girls and that?
That's how a lot of people think. That's how a lot of people
think. If I ignore it, it will go away.
Yes. And
not in the internet era, buddy.
I know. But that's how a lot of people thought. And that's how, you know, pre-internet and pre- all of the information in the world being at your fingertips no matter what. Yeah, that's the way it worked a lot of times. You know, a star would come out and go, I have no idea what you're talking about. And the propaganda machine would go to work and they would bury things that they didn't want to get out about this star. And that's an old relic. But it's still how a lot of propaganda machines still try and work.
Well, what about when you try and discount your early stuff then, and you're clearly contradicting yourself from not only evidence at the time, but evidence, you know, there on camera or, you know, on record or whatever, such as Johnny Depp on 21 Jump Street. He won't even acknowledge he ever did 21 Jump Street, except for he gave some interviews in the mid-90s before he became Johnny Depp. And he said he hated being on the show. He was constantly trying to get fired. It was a miserable experience. And then you talk to the other cast members and they're like, nah, man, he loved it. And then you look at the bloopers and he's having a fun time. And it's like, okay, what you're saying your experience was is totally different from what everyone else got out of you there. And the bloopers prove you were enjoying yourself a lot.
I give them, I'm going to give Depp in this case the benefit of the doubt. And let me tell you why. My wife is nuts. She's crazy. Schizophrenic.
I know your
dealing
wife.
With a lot of stuff. A lot of mental problems. She's talked about it online all the time. Both of us are, you know, very vocal about mental health and everything like that. So we don't hide that at all. During the day, especially when she was on this last medication that didn't work, she's been angry and bitter and bitchy since last September. But when we have people over, you know, when we have guests and we have a dinner party, she puts on the happy face. When she's meeting somebody new or going to work, she puts on a happy face. And it's an immediate switch.
Acting,
so I'm going to give Depp the benefit of the doubt that while he was at work, while he was, you know, going through the bloopers and everything like that, he was joking around, having fun, putting on a happy face. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and say that at the end of the day, when he went back to the apartment building in West Hollywood or wherever,
21 Jump Street was shot in Canada.
I know, but you know, when he went back to his apartment in
Montreal,
Vancouver,
or whatever,
Vancouver or whatever, because if it was shot in Canada, it was probably shot in BC. You know, maybe he went in, shut the door, and the face came off, and he really was truly miserable. I've seen that happen not just to Dawn, but to many sufferers.
But is that then fair to 21 Jump Street? That's what made him a name to get him the movie roles that he now loves. Is that fair to go, yeah, I hated doing that thing that totally made me famous and I'm still playing off of where that got me?
Why do I have to be fair? Nothing says you have to be fair. I'd rather you be honest.
Well, then what about when, to go back to the Hunter S. Thompson example, but for a director, when you clearly gave up, you stopped caring, you are making movies now just to make product, and not to make a movie, that you are just doing this either one out of a job or two, just you like the process and you don't give a shit what the final
or
product looks like.
Or you're contractually obligated?
No, in the two examples I'm thinking of, it's not contractually. It's they just like making movies. They don't care, like David Dakota. You look at all the direct-to-video dreck he's putting out now, he's not even trying. He's not even trying. He is making... you look at David Dakota's early work, and you go, he made movies. Now he makes product. And I think you, of all people, can know the difference between movies and product. And that's what he's making, is product. And that you can tell he does not care at all. Such as that movie, A Talking Cat. Okay? Now... He'd probably claim, it was budgetary why this first example happened. The Talking Cat is voiced by Eric Roberts, who is clearly recorded by a microphone being held up to the speaker of a cell phone. Literally, Eric Roberts phoned in his performance. You can hear the echo, you can hear the metallic twinge, all of it. You can tell that they could not even care enough to go, well, if we're going to get Eric Roberts, we should at least record him. Like, no, just call it in and put it on speaker. We'll just record it off of that and use it. There's that, and because it's a cat, you know, they have to make the cat do what they want, so they got a laser pointer. You can clearly see the laser pointer move. And the face you're making shows that, you know, how do you make a movie like that and just not care? Just, I don't care. It's product. It's done. Put it out.
Is it selling?
Yes.
There you go. And
it's because A Talking Cat is getting the reputation of The Room. Of this movie is so awful, you've got to see it.
Yeah, you know,
but
there you go.
But this is indicative of David Dakota's other work for the past 5 or so years. He just doesn't care. He just put out product.
Well, if it's selling and if it's keeping him in a living and if he enjoys the process, why not?
You know, like the other example would be Tobe Hooper. You know, Tobe Hooper, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Texas Chainsaw 2, Life Force, Invaders from Mars, Eaten Alive, Spontaneous Combustion, a lot of TV work. You know, he's a classic genre director.
Sure.
And even to hear him say it, he didn't put it in these words. He didn't say he gave up, but he said it doesn't matter what the final product turns out to be. He just really enjoys making movies.
Well, okay.
And that to me means you don't give a shit if it's a bad take, if the CGI is terrible, if the script is awful. You just want to be on set going, action! And you don't give a shit anymore.
There's almost something to be admired in that, in a very weird, weird way. There's almost something to be admired of.
I think it's something that should be pilloried. I think it's just sick that, you know, you just gave up. You used to care what the product was. Now it's Ed Wood, one take, done. Okay, I just like being on set.
But it sells.
Not Tobe Hooper's newest stuff.
Well, there you go. You know, and as soon as it stops selling, they'll start caring, I promise.
But, you know,
money is a very, very good motivator.
But in a case of somebody like Tobe Hooper, he's coasting off his name. People are still going, this is the Tobe Hooper that made Texas Chainsaw Massacre, man.
Yeah.
So we put his name on the cover. Even if it's shit, it's going to get some value out of it, doesn't care.
But I'm telling you, as soon as it stops selling, they'll start caring. That's just the way movies work. And it sucks. And I know it's terrible. Nobody does it for the art anymore. But as soon as it stops selling...
You studio flack, you.
Yeah. As soon as it stops selling, they'll start caring. As soon as this horrible remake fever that's been going for 20 years...
I was going to say, it's been a good chunk of our lives, yeah, Scott. So, you know, this is...
As soon as they stop selling, they'll start caring.
But I mean, you know, what's the point? What's the impetus that's going to make people realize that some of their idols just don't have it anymore? I mean, you know, like people are still Frank Miller fanboys, even though all they do is bitch about him. They still buy everything he does because it's Frank Miller. You know, there are still the Tobe Hooper movies people still go to because he made Texas Chainsaw. So it's this whole kind of coasting off of your past accomplishments, even though you're not even in the same area anymore.
They'll go away. It may take a long, long time. And I've known fanboys that it may take a long, long time for it to go away, but it will. People can only be burnt so many times. Frank Miller is only going to be able to objectify, you know, sluts and abuse victims for so long before people go, okay, that's enough.
But in the case of like Frank Miller, his stuff still sells because it's got that Room type reputation where people go, my God, All-Star Batman and Robin is so bad. You've got to read it. So to him, he thinks, hey, I've got a number one selling title. People still love my stuff. And he doesn't quite get it that he's the joke now. They're buying it because it's so awful and put forward with such a straight face.
And to tell you the truth, if I were in his position and I did realize that, I wouldn't care. They're still buying my stuff. And that is the only way that people can let an artist know that they've lost their shit. That's the only way, is to hit them where it hurts, which is leave their product on the shelf. Leave their product at the theater. Don't go see it. Don't.
So you think, like, say, every comic magazine, every comic website out there reviewing All-Star Batman and Robin and calling it one of the worst comics of the 2000s and explaining why, you think that won't get through after 100 of those, that Frank Miller might go, wow, absolutely no one likes this?
Nope.
Really?
Not so long as those checks keep coming in. I wouldn't care.
So you wouldn't care about the quality of the product you're putting out as long as you're putting out product?
If I'm one of these artists, and I think we just mentioned it, I think you're just stating Toby Hooper. You're just stating exactly what you just told me he's doing. And he's just putting out product to put out product.
That's just sad.
It is. But that's the way that this works is we spend our money on products that we want to see more of. Obviously, there's enough of a Frank Miller fan base out there that they want to see more.
Because they want to see how much more insane he'll get.
Who cares?
I do.
If I'm Frank Miller, who gives a damn? Oh, my fans want to see how much more insane we get. Okay. Death of Wonder Woman coming out in 2 months and blah, blah, blah. And you know, I'll kill her by having her gang raped by a future Joker's gang or something. And
I wouldn't put it past him to pull a... I wouldn't put it past him to pull a Scientology kind of thing. It wasn't Battlefield Earth. It was one of his earlier stories where the two main characters were lesbians who, after being raped repeatedly, finally realized that they were wrong and that men were good.
Well, see, there,
you know, that kind of stuff is just offensive.
Yes, I agree. But as long as people keep buying it, and it doesn't matter the reasons, it doesn't matter if people are buying the product that I'm making, if people are listening to this show because they want to see what kind of insane shit you're going to say and not because we have...
I like how you just pin that on me and not you at all, huh?
If people are tuning in to see what kind of insane shit you're going to say... And not because we have these beautiful insights or our own little views on the 80s and 90s and growing up being the lost in the static generation, blah, 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 blah. Fine. They're tuning in. They're listening. They're going to Adam and Eve and using the promo code static. They're using our Amazon links.
That's not good enough for me. I don't need people to like me, but... I need people to know that I am doing my best and I am not half-assing it and I am not coasting.
And I think that comes across...
Whether they hate me or not.
I think that comes across in our show. I mean, we have not reached that Frank Miller area of we're just going, welcome to Lost in the Static.
It's been an hour.
Yeah, you know, we're not doing that, and I think that's coming across in our show, and if it's not, please, dear God, let us know. But because Josh and I really do put both of us put our all into this show, and we try and make a decent product, and I hope that we continue.
We fail.
I hope that we continue to try to make a decent product, at least, and we never reach any kind of... Okay, I want to be successful. I want to reach that plateau. I really do. That deal of you look at the Howard Stern show and the early Howard Stern show and it had a political message and it was funny and it was biting humor and then now you watch now and they're like, boobies and midgets. And
that's pretty much what it's devolved into, man.
I'd love to be able to reach that kind of financial plateau of going, I don't care, but... That's the thing. This is a labor of love. I'm always going to care. But
and we don't have any financial security.
Exactly. None whatsoever. But, you know, I think that's part of where artists lose their shit as they finally get secure and they kind of realize that, you know, no matter what I do, people are going to buy my shit. I think that's right where Frank Miller is. If I were Frank Miller, I'd be going, everybody's expecting me to go insane. Okay, let's live up to the expectations. There's another royalty check in the bank.
And again, I think, maybe some people don't care. I think you're tainting your legacy, even tangentially. You know, because people are not going to remember Frank Miller for being a comics visionary in the early 80s. They're going to remember, I'm the goddamn Batman. Yeah. And is that really what you want to be remembered for?
In our case, no. But we have this weird thing called integrity, and we're doing this weird thing called struggling.
I don't think anyone has ever accused me of having integrity before, but fair enough.
Well, you honestly believe the shit you spew.
Yeah.
And you stand up for it, and you don't bullshit around it.
Yeah.
And when you see good or bad in your friends, even if they are friends, if they're doing something stupid, you call them on it.
I think that's what being a friend is.
To me, that's integrity. You're honest. I hate to say this, folks, but Josh is one of the more honest people I've ever known, and we have got to go. Thanks for joining us. Bye.
Lost in the Static is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.